This is the Homebrew Game Club, a podcast about modern, brand new, aftermarket video games for retro consoles. On this podcast, we usually pick one game a month to play and talk about, but today we just decided to turn on the mics and just bullshit a little bit. No playing any games or anything like that. We're just going to hang out. So I have no idea exactly what we're going to talk about. Well, I have a little couple of things on the docket here, but yeah. So my name is Nick, also known as Divertov, and with me today are
Bart, also known as Clever Username Needed, and I really need a username. I'm getting sick of that one.
And Connor Nash, also known as Connor Nash on social media.
Now, maybe that can be our next contest, our next giveaway, is give Bart a new handle.
Yeah, I'll do it.
Okay, I'm not going to read our disclaimer because we're not talking about games. But if I say anything mean about anybody's homebrew game, I apologize. I don't know what I'm talking about, so don't worry about my opinion.
It should be noted at this point, Nick is in a state of delirium.
Yes. I'm only halfway conscious right now. So no, I'm sick. I'm sick. My kid had diarrhea all night. I was explaining to you guys, like, it was coming out so loud I could actually hear him from across my house.
And borderline explosive.
Yeah, it actually woke me up. That's how loud it was coming out. And my wife, of course, is just sitting there like dead asleep. So I was like, all right, I guess this is my job. So now I sat there with him. Like, he went back to the bathroom like four times within an hour. And I was just kind of like coaching him through it, you know. But
I usually get woken up by my own diarrhea, but not by somebody else's. That's impressive.
Yeah, no. But now I think I got what he got. So now I'm sitting here right now. I have the...
You're actually on the bathroom pot right now. You're just...
Yeah, that's where I've got my setup here, where I'm actually sitting in my bathroom. So it's
you've dampened the acoustics very well.
I've dampened the acoustics. I don't
so
have
beware.
The one, so yeah, but if
at times this podcast might sound like shit.
So lightly, ooh, we're going to be lightly edited. So I don't know. I may leave the grunts in, but we'll. Oh my god! Okay. Guys, we got, we are going to talk about a couple things today. We have a Discord channel that is called Ask the Podcast, and it was a fun little thing to do for a little while, where we would, just let anybody submit whatever kind of questions they might want to hear us answer when we record. And I think we got some good content out of that, but the downside to it, the reason we haven't gone back to it in a while, I don't think there'd been a question in there in about 6 months. The reason we kind of stopped doing it on the podcast is when we record, we sit here for 2 or 3 hours, and that section of the podcast was usually kind of at the back end. It was at the tail after we'd been sitting here for about 3 hours already, and we were tired, and that's just the excuse that we have. We didn't have anything left in the tank, and every episode, we kept bumping it to the next episode, and it got to the point where I just stopped putting it on the schedule. So,
wasn't that like a thing, was it Jimmy Kimmel had or something, where it's like, Matt Damon's going to be on the show tonight, and like he never showed up, they didn't have time to get to him.
Yep. Yes, right. But
so these questions are the Matt Damon of this podcast.
Well, we had some good ones that we hadn't answered, and so I wanted to go back and maybe...
Oh yeah, no, I think that it bears repeating, like, it's not like we weren't interested in these questions, it literally was just the fuel in the tank problem.
Yeah. Well, and so last year, what we did, so I think we put this out in January, where we talked about all the games that we had played throughout the year, and I had not considered doing that this year because I have not hardly played any games besides the ones that we played for this podcast. And the games that I have played fall into one of two categories. They're either shoot 'em ups, which I seem to be addicted to right now, and that's cool, but they are not particularly interesting, I think, to talk about, except for people who are really into shoot 'em ups.
Or so, if you're going to be listening to our next episode about shoot 'em ups.
Well, yeah, we do have it. Yeah. Well, okay. So this might come out after that episode, but yeah, as we are recording, this is in early December and we have a cool tournament going on. I think it's fun.
I think it's cool too.
But yeah, we got some folks participating where we are doing 3 shoot 'em ups, but that by the time you hear this, that episode will probably already be out. But I'm having a real good time with this stuff.
Mm-hmm. I should probably start playing them.
Dude, they are really good.
They are good, and they are short, but they are two of them especially are pretty tough. So, Omega Dude, Blast is like
let's hold on to
okay,
those.
Okay, yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't want to spoil it, but yeah. But no, the other reason I don't have any games to talk about is because one of the games I played this year with was Breath of the Wild. It was all I fucking played for like 6 months. So I had texted Bart. I'm like, let's jump on and do an episode about Breath of the Wild because I have all these opinions about it. And I was just going to call the episode Nick Played Breath of the Wild and he wants to talk about it.
It reminds me a little bit of Netflix, because Netflix, when they were like really like peak and they were the only streaming service in town, they did analysis on people's behaviors and whatever. And they realized that they didn't actually have any competition. Nobody was actually competing with Netflix because they couldn't stream, you know, well enough or whatever.
Right.
So the only competition that they had was actually people going to sleep. That was the equation. It was like, it's right. Netflix versus sleep. I feel like the Breath of the Wild equation was kind of like that. Where it's
yeah,
like,
yeah. No, that's exactly what happened.
Wild or am I sleeping?
Yeah, well, that's what happened to me. And I, many nights, Breath of the Wild won.
Exactly.
Oh, I mean, I don't know how many nights I was up. You know, I was, because here's the thing. My take on this game is I liked it, but I didn't love it. But I also found it impossible to put down.
Yes. Like, there are so many nights where I'd be like, oh, fuck, it's 4 a.m.
Yeah, that's what I did. And I had to go to work the next day. You know, like my kids are going to get up and go to school here in about 3 hours. You know, I'm like, yeah. What the hell am I doing? I got to put this away. And yeah, I'm sure. I mean,
but first,
I probably had people thinking I was on drugs or something, because I'd be like, I come into work and I just be like, oh, God, you know, it's like, what were you doing last night? I was saving Hyrule like a fucking dork.
And now you know how heroin addicts have their whole fucking career. Like that's because they're people who are higher functioning addicts.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's what I'm a high functioning video game addict. I guess that's my thing. So
I saw myself dropping down that rabbit hole again, literally this time with Tears of the Kingdom. And I actually quit playing it because I was like, I can't go through this again for another 6 months. Like, I just walked away from it because it was just too much.
Yeah, well, see, my boys wanted to watch me play it. So they would, anytime I beat one of the big divine beasts, you know, which are the big dungeon levels in the game, I would let them watch. You know, they got real excited about seeing me finish those. So they got kind of into it. Yeah, as soon as I beat Ganon at the end, spoiler alert, you have to beat Ganon at the end of the game. But no, as soon as I finished it, like my older son was like, great, now you can go get Tears of the Kingdom and play that. And I was like, I thought you wanted it, because he kept bugging me to finish this game so we could get Tears of the Kingdom. I said, I thought you were going to play Tears of the Kingdom. He's like, no, I'm going to watch you play it. Oh my God. I told him, I'm like, I'm not doing that anytime soon.
Dude, that is at least at the level of volunteering to look after a Cub Scout meeting. Like, come on.
It was a part-time job. Yeah. No.
Yeah.
No. So I put, you know, I've talked before, like I don't have a ton of time to play video games. Apparently I have more time than I thought. All I have to do is just not sleep.
There you go.
But,
No,
I put over the 6 months that I played this game, according to my Switch, I put 130 hours into it. That's, which is wild when you think about it. You know, but the Switch, you can do that because you just take it with you, right?
Well, that's the thing. I was just going to say, and this will probably come up later in this particular episode, but I just got myself an analog pocket.
Yeah.
It's real nice. I'm really happy with it. But that's the whole point, right? Now it's on the go and you can just like be on the bus or whatever and be playing it. And yeah, it works.
Yeah. Yeah, no, so I did like the game. I don't know. I had not played through an entire Zelda game since the, what is it, Ocarina of Time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because I got so tired of the story, like, and the same characters over and over. And there's just something about the Zelda world that I'm just not into, like, that.
I kind of was into it, because I did Twilight Princess and I did Skyward Sword, and they are sometimes regarded as, like, not as cool, right? But, like, Twilight Princess in particular, I think, really, like, quote-unquote underrated jam. Really,
I loved
really
it.
Good. Yeah, really, really
never
good.
Never played.
I tried. I picked them up, and I would play a little bit of them, but I'm just like, I just can't do the freaking Link and Zelda and Ganon thing again. It's just, Nathan Tolbert said this on Discord. He's like, you know, I don't care about story in Zelda games, you know? So he's just kind of ignores it. I mean, and you can see when he made a Zelda game, it didn't barely had a story, right? Like this one, for once, I actually liked the story. I liked the lore, because like for the first 10 hours I was playing the game, I was just like, it just seemed kind of dumb to me. It's like, it seemed like such a, my thing about Zelda is this Breath of the Wild. You go in there and it's got this open world feeling. You can the game wears its influences on its sleeve.
Oh,
you know, it's very influenced by Skyrim. I would say Shadow of the Colossus.
Absolutely.
Huge influence there.
So much. Like, I mean, you cannot look at that game having played Shadow of the Colossus and not think of that game immediately.
Absolutely. Yeah. With the divine beasts and everything. But just the look of it, you know. But, you know, the thing about Shadow of the Colossus is it's desolate. It's empty. And you get this entire feeling the entire time that you're there that you're not supposed to be there.
Yeah. You know? It's a very unique feeling. Like you're a hero in a world that doesn't want you.
Whereas in Breath of the Wild, it felt like just the opposite. Like, it felt like a very, it felt, you know, it's an open world, but it also feels very contained. And it feels like it's contained in a way, it's just for you, the player character. Like, and that's in this story, you know, there's like every 10,000 years, this guy comes along and the princess and they defeat the evil beast. And that is like the whole, and then it happens again. But that is the whole purpose of this world. That is what it exists for. And, you know, you just say they're like, why are there temples everywhere that have been sitting here for, you know, closed for 10,000 years until this one guy comes along and to get his trinket and that's it. That's the entire purpose of this fucking temple. Like, that's just insane. But if you think of it as like, you know, this self-contained world as per the lore, like that's the whole reason this world exists. I mean, it's kind of interesting. You know, if you consider it, it's like this little bubble universe, but I don't know. It took me a while to get used to that concept. It felt really artificial to me. Like it felt open world and cool, but it also felt super artificial. And, I don't know. I had a really weird reaction to the game for the first, dozen hours or so that I was with it. And then I just started having fun with it. But
I don't know, man. I had the same feeling playing Breath of the Wild for the first 10-12 hours that I did playing the first Legend of Zelda.
Oh, really?
That feeling of anything's possible, crazy open exploration, no signposts whatsoever. You know, it's just like you can go wherever you want, but there's an obvious route that you probably should go, you know.
I think that's an interesting point that it's like it doesn't feel constrained, but it does feel like made almost in this like narcissistic way just for the player.
Yeah.
Like it's really made just for you, which is not a bad thing per se.
I don't have a problem
just,
with that at all.
Right. But at the same time, it's like when you look at its influences, like Shadow of the Colossus, that is pretty much the opposite of what the point of that game is.
Yes, exactly. Right.
So it's like the open world idea arguably is the idea that the world is not for you, right? You're exploring a world. And like, and even... I can't believe I'm going to do this.
You can say Super Mario Brothers 2?
Even a game like Lizard, where you're trying to, you know, explore a world that's not really made with your own machinations and desires in mind, that is possibly a band. You know, I'm not even going to finish that point, whatever.
No, but I know what you're saying. No, Lizard definitely does not want you there. You definitely get that vibe.
There we go.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely it. You know, it's but I didn't like that, how artificial it felt that way. And I don't know. I got to where I got into it. You know, like when you get strong enough that you can just climb over anything, you know, you just be like, okay, that mountain, what's on the other side of it? I'm just going to like make a straight freaking line for the mountain and go over the top of it. You know, like that's a very cool feeling when you're that, you know, powerful that you can do that. But, I don't know, especially just, in the beginning, remember my favorite game of all time, Fallout, you know, New Vegas, Fallout 3, these kind of games, you know, I like that kind of open world game. But I mean, you play a game like New Vegas and it's full of these characters who you get this sense that even when you're not there talking to them, like they have lives that continue, you know, there's this, it's kind of a realistic sort of gritty feel to that world. Whereas this game is like the opposite. I felt like if I'm not here standing here, like talking to these people, like they're not real characters. They're just, this is a video game. I could never stop thinking that I'm in a video game, you know? And I don't know. I mean, that's fine if people don't care about that. But I mean, like to me, it was just part of the fun of an open world is that immersive quality. And I just never got quite immersed in it. You know, I don't know.
Well, let's get immersed in these questions.
Oh my gosh. What a transition. Holy cow.
Whoa.
All right.
Call you Dean Kamen. That was a hell of a segue.
Wow. All right.
Oh, we're that on fire.
That was definitely a 40-year-old guy joke right there.
Before we leave the Zelda thing, though, did either of you guys play Majora's Mask? Because I totally skipped it. And it's one of those games
I've heard it's really good.
That's what I hear.
Really good. I've liked it a lot. I've played it a lot. It is, for some people, I know quite a few people who say it's their favorite Zelda game.
Yeah, very good.
But
what console was it? Was that GameCube or Wii?
No, it was the N64 originally, but it's...
was it really? Oh my
God. It really takes... It was like basically, because in the original Zelda 64, Ocarina of Time, the mask idea was kind of novel. It was like this kind of... But it was kind of half-baked. You know, it was like, okay, if you wear a mask on some days, talking to some characters, you get some kind of dialogue that's kind of cool.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Majora's Mask made the mask thing totally central to the whole game. The whole game was based on the mask dynamic. There's like 30 masks you can get. And there's like masks that are like hidden. Like you would read about things online. Like you can get this mask that makes you like, something to do with like one of the relationships between a husband and wife in the game. And you can pretend to be one of the, it's a really weird thing. It feels like it's like made up, but it's actually in the game. It's really cool. The music stuff I really loved because now you could play the bongos as the Goron and you played like this electric guitar as a Zora. Like it's really out there. Huh. It has a lot going for it. I would say that's definitely top three Zelda games, big time.
I played through one on Nintendo DS and it was the Zelda game I spent the most time with in the last like friggin' 20 years. Yeah, I guess that's true. 20 years. God damn. we're old. It was the Phantom Hourglass on Nintendo DS, and that is considered like a very minor Zelda game. It is, it had that like weird chibi art where they have like big heads and it, you know. But yeah, I liked it pretty well, but it has this awful mechanic where you have to go back to the final dungeon and you keep going back there. You have to go back. Every time you go back, you get a little bit further into the dungeon, but then you have to come back out. And yeah, after like the freaking fifth time I had to go back to that dungeon, I was just like, I'm not doing this again. This is stupid. So yeah, I got like 90% of the way through the game and put it down because I this is dumb.
Sometimes the game just doesn't work.
Yeah, I mean, that was a really dumb mechanic.
I'd rather find out at 15% than 90% though.
Yeah, I don't know. I just couldn't convince myself to go back. But yeah.
Did you watch the Fallout trailer I sent you?
I did. Yeah, for the TV show.
I haven't watched it yet.
Prime Video. Yeah. I don't know about that.
I don't know how they're going to make it into a decent 10-episode story arc. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. It had this... Fallout is such a weird tone.
Yeah.
You know, it's such a weird mix of, like, gritty and apocalyptic and also, like, slapstick humor. You know?
Yeah, weird absurdity, yeah.
Yeah, absurd humor, I guess I should say. And I think it looked in the trailer like that they're trying to hit that, and boy, that is a narrow target. I don't know.
Hard note to hit there.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I did see Walton Goggins, and he's good at that, so that might, I don't know, we'll see.
Oh, yeah. Okay, all right. We got to get back on track here. So, we had this wonderful transition of these questions, and then we dropped it. All right. So we had a bunch of questions from our Discord channel, Ask the Podcast, and we never answered any of the questions. So, we did. We answered a few. But I think if maybe the last time we answered one of these was, didn't we talk about video game food or something like that? It was...
I said the pretzel from Pac-Man.
Yeah, the pretzel from Pac-Man. I don't remember which episode that was, but it was several ago. So, All right. I'm just going to go... let me see. I'm just going to pull some at random from this list I got here. Okay, this first one, this is the farthest back I found. Raftronaut had some silly questions. And this one kind of puzzled me. What is your desert island laundry detergent? Now, I think there are a couple ways to look at this question. Like, is he saying, what is your all-time favorite laundry detergent? Or is this like, if you were actually trapped on a desert island, what laundry detergent would you want to have with you?
So, it's like bubbling up inside of me. There's clearly only one correct answer to this question. Like, it's not even the question. It's like
motherfucking Tide Pods, right?
Tide. It's, you're on an island. It's, there's waves. It's the fucking tide.
All right. That makes sense.
I'm going to say none, because if I'm on a desert island, I'm not wearing clothes.
Right, that's the practical answer, right?
Yeah. Why would you need to wash your clothes on a desert island? I would be more concerned about other things. Like,
do you have a dishwasher or a dishwasher? A washing machine? No.
Yeah, so I would say my desert island laundry detergent would be like, maybe, like, I'm thinking whatever comes in like the largest and most durable packaging, you know, like a big jug that maybe I could use to carry water or something. So
the first thing I would do is just pour out the laundry detergent in the sand, fucking rinse it out, and then use it as a water jug. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I thought you were saying Tide Pods. Like, at least you can, you know, you may not have food or water, but at least you can, like, get high on the Tide Pods.
Oh,
just suck them down.
Weren't the kids doing that? I don't know. I don't know what the kids
are. All the kids.
They're mad. The kids eating the Tide Pods. All right. Next question. Dale Coop asks, what would be a good length of a homebrew game? Does size matter?
Well, guys.
Depends.
It depends. I mean, let's be honest. It's not the size. It's what you do with it. Come on.
There you go.
I mean, what's a good length for any game? And I don't think it has to be a homebrew game. You know,
that's a very fair point.
I'd love to be able to finish some games in one sitting. Other times, I wish a game would go on forever and ever and ever because it's so good. It really depends, you know?
Yeah, and I think you can look back on the games that we talked about on this podcast and see different takes on this. Like, you know, we just played Kubo 3. Dale Coops and his son made Kubo 3. Which is a short game. Super short game. Like, you can, almost anybody can beat that game. Any, you know, adult, I guess, can beat that game in an hour. But, you know, it's more like, see, a game like that, I think, is almost like an art project, you know, and it's like, it's just, that's fine to be kind of contained in and of itself and in a very short experience like that. There was a game, and he's talking about homebrew games. There was a game I played a long time ago that was actually an art project. It was called Passage. And it was a mobile game by this guy who makes these art games. I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but it's a 5-minute game. And you play it. It is like a life simulator. It's like a top-down kind of thing with very basic graphics. But you start off and you're very young and you have all these pathways that are open to you. And as the game progresses, you get older and older and you move slower. And you find that whatever path you've chosen, other paths are shut off to you. And in the beginning, what's ahead of you is very fuzzy, and at the end, like, what's behind you is very fuzzy, and what's in front of you is very clear. And then you, at some point, you just randomly die, and that's the entire game. And it is, I thought, you know, it's very moving. I thought it was a great, what do you call it? What is that term? Memento mori. Yeah.
Oh, remember me.
Yeah, I thought it was a great little reflection on mortality, and very interesting. People used to ask the question: can games be art? I don't think anybody asks me that anymore because it's.
I think that's a very good point. Yeah,
I think it's self-evident that games certainly can be. But, you know, I say a game like that, and like that's, you know, that's the kind of thing that you might see in like some kind of modern museum exhibit. You know,
right?
But
right.
I played it once, and I felt like this is a game I only want to play once because I chose my path, and that was it. And then I walked away from it. I only ever spent 5 minutes on that game, and I still think about it.
Hmm. I definitely am a fan of shorter games for a whole bunch of reasons right now. Number one, I don't have a lot of time to play. That's like probably the most pressing aspect of it. Number two, I think to your point, games are art. Nobody's debating that anymore. So it's not like there's a point to prove. It means if you just want to do a specific kind of message or some kind of idea in a game, you don't have to like prove that you need to do it in a game. It's like, oh, cool, it's in a game. So that's a legitimate artistic format of performing this art or whatever.
Yeah.
And then like, honestly, I think there's just this really nice thing that, like, if you've got a smaller game, you're probably going to refine it really well. Like, if you've got a really big game.
That's true.
It's actually really hard to refine that game and make it excellent in all of the areas that it's supposed to be. Like as a kind of example of this, like Breath of the Wild. Like, how many hundreds of people do you really think worked on Breath of the Wild?
Yeah. Right?
That was probably a 8-figure budget. Like, you're talking Hollywood budget level, hundreds and hundreds of people working on something. When you go down to like the level of one, maybe two or three creators, the smaller it is, sometimes the more likely you are to get that vision delivered and have that particular execution done really well. So I'm kind of almost, I'm not skeptical of bigger games, but I find it harder to say, oh, I'm excited for a big game. There's obvious exceptions, and we've spoken about something like Full Quiet many times. But like, if you're talking to like a just any kind of random Kickstarter that's starting up, if the scope of that Kickstarter is monumentally large and it's got this huge idea for what it's going to do, I'm immediately skeptical that they're going to be able to deliver on that vision.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. Well, and I think a good contrast to the long game is the like the shoot 'em ups, you know, that we've been playing. So like you look at something like Picaris, you know, Picaris is a game that Flight of Picaris, it's a 5-minute game, but it's extremely well designed. The developer of that, it took him 2.5 years to make a 5-minute game.
Wow.
And it is just a very well designed 5 minutes, and you can just feel it. You know, it's
to be fair, probably not 40 hours a week.
No. Hours, but yeah. He worked on it off and on over 2.5 years. But and the only last thing I want to say about that is that this question did make me think about Bart. We talked about this a long time ago in our first episode. You used to have an attitude that I see a lot still today, which is this idea that, you know, if you're going to pay full price for a game, you know, if I'm going to buy like a modern $70 game for a PS5 or something, then I want a full experience out of it. It better be a long ass game. Mm-hmm. And people get mad because the game is only like 100 hours long. And it's like, well, I paid $70 and it's only 100 hours. Like, why, you know, it could be longer. Why not? To me, you don't have that philosophy anymore, do you?
I actually have that philosophy this week. I bought myself a PSVR 2 and I messed around with the demo for Horizon Call of the Mountain, and it's fantastic 15-minute demo. And I was like, I got to get this game. And I was doing a little research, and it's $70 for an 8-hour game.
Oh, really?
And I'm like, I don't know if I want to drop $70 for a game that takes 8 hours to play. I don't know. I'll drop 20, I guess, for a movie that's 2 hours, but still, it's just, I kind of do have that, have that still.
I don't know. Yeah. To me, it's like, that is kind of like a game as product. It's like, to me, you know, it's 8 hours, but that's like, if I have like a really fun 8 hours, like that's worth it to me.
True. Know? Well, there's also this news story that came out about Rockstar and Grand Theft Auto 6 and like the possibility of paying per hour that you play, and the rumor that it might cost $150 and shit like that.
It's, oh, wow.
Like, I don't know if I'd be down for that. That's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah.
Even though Rockstar Games and the Grand Theft Auto series is like one of my all-time favorite series.
Okay, let's move on with our questions here. So that was Dale Coop. What would be a good length of a homebrew game? Houston asked, now see, we were going to do an episode on this. We didn't. You should do an extras on the Mario movie. That was not a question.
I'm ready for this. I'm ready for the controversial takes. I'm ready for the angry takes.
I had all kinds of notes. We were going to record an entire freestanding episode about the Mario movie, and we just never got around to it. But I have, in fact, sitting on my desk right now, you can see it here. It says SMB movie notes. Huh. I have this.
A whole book?
But it's one of these little, I have all these dumb freaking notebooks sitting around. Oh, yeah. This was it's one of these Moleskine, you know, these notebooks that people would buy and then never use. And I have one of these. I probably bought this like 20 years ago. No, and I did. I wrote down like quite a bit of notes from this movie. And I don't remember any of them.
Yeah, it has now been too long since I've seen
it. It's been too long. Yeah, my mojo is gone. I will say the one thing that I really liked about that movie is that it made canon the fact that Mario and Luigi are Italian-Americans from Brooklyn. So, suck it, Japan. They're ours now. Okay. Yeah, that's right.
Well, I've got plenty of takes because I actually wrote down my takes when I saw the movie because I thought, well, first of all, I knew you were not going to like it. So, you know, I felt like
I liked it fine. I thought it was kind of, I thought the plot was kind of bland. It was just like, yeah, whatever, you know.
I think that it does honestly deserve the $1 billion revenue that it got. Because it is, if it wasn't for Barbie, that would have been the most successful movie of the year.
Yeah.
Which is incredible to think. Like that the Mario movie missed out from another 80s icon I know Barbie existed before the 80s, but like, you know what I'm saying here? Like, it's this like millennial kids coming of age, bringing their kids to the movies thing. There's something really wild about that, making movies billion-dollar IPs. But the other thing in particular that I think is really interesting about the Mario movie, which I think really tapped into that Barbie zeitgeist, is that I don't think Mario is the main character in the Mario movie.
Oh, yeah. Huh. Who is?
Peach.
Okay.
Peach is the main character in the Mario movie. She's the one who has the character development. She's the one who has the motivation. She's the one who has all of the plot points are just oriented and orbiting her. She's the one who actually moves the plot forward by doing things. Mario just sits there and like is told to do shit like jump on all these fucking blocks. Like, he has no agency, no control over the plot. He just kind of sits there. And then at the very end, he like touches a star or shit. Like, you know, it's, yeah, it's a great climax, but like, there's no story character development. He's just some dude who gets told what to do. And like, yeah. Bowser, awesome villain, right? Totally also moves the plot forward and does a lot of like cool stuff there. But Mario is not the main character of the Mario movie.
Interesting.
I think it's actually a good movie if you look at it that way.
Yeah. I have a thought about that I'm not going to discuss in a public forum. I'll tell you when we're done.
Wow. All right. Spicy take. Too spicy for the podcast.
Too spicy. Right. The Bart's podcast is starting.
I thought Luigi was underutilized. I'll say that.
I think that's fair.
He spent most of the movie like in a cage. What the hell? Okay. Let me see. Eric Wilder asks, so with the Atari release of the 2600 Plus, are all independently made 2600 games technically no longer considered homebrew? Well, and I would say that go even further with that, when they bought Atari Age, which is a publisher of hacks and ports and homebrews to the Atari consoles, you know, now that Atari officially owns those, are those Atari games? You know, if you are an Atari collector, are you now obligated to buy all of those to have the full set?
Be careful with what you say, because your answer will dictate whether or not we can ever do another 2600 game.
Why is that?
If you say yes, that they are no longer considered homebrew.
Oh, that's right. That's right. They're not eligible for the podcast. Oh my God.
So slow your roll.
I don't know that my criteria are that strict, but yeah. Yeah, you know, I was thinking about this last night. Like, how would I answer this question? So there was some good conversation going back and forth. Nathan Tolbert had some thoughts on this, and it several people chimed in. After I've thought about it for a while, let me look at it this way. All right, is this Atari company Atari? Because think of all the different owners that Atari has had over the years. Atari very famously kind of flamed out as a company. And everybody considered it dead, I think rightfully so, for decades, you know, and it still kind of chugged on in this, like, this zombie corporate entity.
Are you going to make a philosophical argument about a ship of Theseus approach?
How did you know I was going to go there? Is Atari a ship of Theseus? It's like, it's not even Atari anymore, because so for people who aren't familiar, ship of Theseus is this thought experiment where if Theseus has a ship, and you replace every single component of that ship, is it still the same ship of Theseus? Is Atari still Atari? I think there's a very plausible argument to be made that it is a totally different company. It just happens to have the same branding. I don't think that's a stretch to say that.
I don't think it's a stretch, but at the same time, the Atari 2600 is still the Atari 2600.
True.
That's, I think, the challenge here. I think we can all accept a ship of Theseus argument about the company and the IP and whatever, but like, if you bought an Atari 2600, and you have it, that hasn't Theseused itself away, you know? That's still the fucking 2600 you bought.
Well, but I'm just talking about, like, could you consider these now, like, licensed games?
Would you play them on a 2600?
Yeah.
Well, then, I don't know, like, it's made by the Atari company, it's on the Atari 2600, they own the company, like, it's more, like, tangible than that, like, it's not just this aspect. I don't know. I just feel like it's the only reason I'm giving them this level of credence and like benefit of the doubt is I've actually heard both of you talk about how this particular iteration of the Atari company has tried really hard to make the fans happy.
Yeah, they're doing okay. Mm-hmm. There's some things where I feel like they really could have improved, but I think generally they've been going in the right direction.
I think they're kind of diluting their brand at this point because they have the new Atari 2600 Plus that's out. Then they have the other one that has the built-in games and all this flashback stuff. And it's like, what's the official Atari right now?
Yeah, you know? they do feel like they're kind of fishing around and trying to see what's going to work and what isn't.
Yeah.
But
then they had the VCS that came out a couple years ago, which looked so cool, and it was a little expensive. But I
have to give them credit for trying, though. I mean, like, yeah, nobody's ever done what they've done, which is, like, try to reinvigorate, you know, games that are, at this point, almost 50 years old. You know? Yeah. That's crazy.
It'd be like Nintendo putting out a brand new NES that took cartridges.
If Nintendo did that, like if they started buying up, you know, NES publishers, just to use Nintendo as an example, and so, you know, you say like Game Boy or NES, what if they did that and then they just started like retroactively handing out Nintendo seals of quality to different homebrew? Collector heads would just explode.
That is a really interesting kind of way to frame it.
Like, you know, it's like, okay, now you've got Witch and Wiz gets a Nintendo seal of quality. And Houston doesn't have to use his Matt Houston, everybody, take a drink.
Take a drink.
But, you know, Houston was, he has almost like a parody. It's like a seal of quality. I think it has an actual seal on it. But
right.
Like the animal.
But then what about something like Spaceraft that ends up getting a Switch release? That's technically a Nintendo seal of quality by getting an official release, right?
Yeah, I think that's arguable, but it's on that console. True. Like, they don't have anything to say about the original, like the 8-bit cartridge.
Yeah, fair enough. So. Okay.
No, but this, I think that's a good point, Barb, because it's like, you know, the Nintendo seal of quality is not the Nintendo Entertainment System seal of quality. Mm. It's like the company itself.
Mm-hmm. Oh, boy, we are getting into the weeds here. I love it.
This ICS is not going to ship itself, guys. Come on, let's go. We're going to do this all night if we have to.
That's so crazy. I never heard Ship of Theseus in my life, but my grandpa put it to me whenever I was a kid as, all right, let's say George Washington chopped down the cherry tree and I have his axe, but sometime in the 1800s, the handle got rotten. So somebody put a new handle on it. Mm-hmm. And then in 1953, I left it out in the rain and the head got all rusted. So I took the head off and put a new head on it. Is it still George Washington's hatchet that he used to chop down the cherry tree? No. Or yes.
Yeah.
And that's really cool. I had no idea that it was actually.
Yeah. That's actually how most people in the UK and Ireland are introduced to it too, but not through the George Washington.
Well, of course not.
Metaphor. It's this, it's actually a sitcom that was on in the 80s called Only Fools and Horses. And there was this guy who was a street sweeper and he says, yeah, I've had this broom for 30 years. I got an award for, you know, sweeping the streets for 30 years. So he goes, what do you mean you've had a broom sweeping streets for 30 years? How could that broom last 30 years? Oh, yeah, I've replaced the head 6 times and replaced the handle 4 times. Same broom, though.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. It's like the audience is laughing, but you're like, well, is it the same broom?
Yeah, is it the same broom? Right. Cool. I'm glad we can. I always love going philosophical on the Homebrew Game Club podcast.
Yeah.
That's what we're here for.
Or it's like the Tootsie Roll manufacturers take the old batch of Tootsie Rolls from the day before and throw it in the new day's batch. So there's a really a possibility that there could be some of the original Tootsie Roll still in the Tootsie Roll.
It's like
eating.
Sourdough starter. It's just like there's something there.
You got the mother Tootsie Roll out there. Sometimes it tastes like it. I'm not going to lie.
All right. Next question. Raftronaut asks, the frog from Frogger is clearly going to work based on the briefcase they're carrying. So if you look at the graphic of the Frogger arcade cabinet, it is a frog and he's got, okay, I'm looking at this. It is a very realistic looking frog, but he is wearing a tie and he has a little vest on and he is holding a briefcase. Okay. And he is going.
Oh yeah.
I assume he's about to cross the street here.
Mm-hmm. Now, I rarely allude to conversations we have before we press the record button. But Bart and I.
Oh, I was going to jump right into it.
Oh, okay.
I know. So I want to just like disarm this like tension here.
Yeah.
Let me ask the actual question. What type of job do you think the Frogger frog is commuting to?
Okay.
Where is he going?
Bart, before you jump in.
I will.
I've got my own personal answer and then I've got another answer.
Oh.
I think you've got another answer too.
Oh, I do. I looked at Connor. I was like, you know, I'm thinking about this Frogger thing. And I decided, what the fuck? I'm going to type the question into ChatGPT and see what it comes back with, right? And I said, all right. I said, the frog from Frogger is going to a job. Where does he work? make it funny. And that's just what I said. And it came back with two answers. And here we go. This is what ChatGPT told me. The frog from Frogger works as a, quote, jump consultant, helping other frogs navigate the perilous paths of life with his unparalleled expertise in leaping across busy streets and avoiding dangerous obstacles. His briefcase is filled with top secret froggy jumping strategies and a lifetime supply of fly snacks. And I said, no, give me another one. So then it says, the frog from Frogger works as a, quote, webbed developer, specializing in creating innovative and cutting-edge amphibious websites. His briefcase is full of files, bugs, and a USB stick with the latest version of HopML, hopping markup language. That's what I got from ChatGPT.
Okay. That's really good. We should get ChatGPT on the podcast.
Oh, look. Okay, this is my favorite
thing. This is way funnier than any shit I can come up with.
My favorite thing about ChatGPT is that it's not about ChatGPT. It's about what you put into ChatGPT, right?
Yeah, yeah.
First of all, yes, that's an amazing fucking answer. And may I say, I prefer the hopping consultant. I think that's actually the superior answer.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So I'm gonna tell you. I love this question.
Me too.
My like personal take is I look at the Frogger picture and I think he's a teacher. I can't tell you why, but I think he's a teacher who's going to a job because he's got this like briefcase that like feels like it's got kids' homework in it or something. Mm-hmm. And he's like late and he's like...
He's got a real sense of urgency about him.
Yeah, he's got this urgency that's really weird. But I asked ChatGPT and what I've done, my ChatGPT that I've like configured is like, please give me the most curt and like just straight up answer because I'm fed up with this whole like, as an AI language model, I can't possibly... Like, fuck it, give me the answer. So I said, Frog from Frogger is clearly going to work based on the briefcase they're carrying. What type of job do you think the Frogger Frog is going to? Accountant. That's it.
Okay.
So I said, elaborate. And it said, well, the Frogger Frog, known for its precise and calculated movements to avoid obstacles, suits the role of an accountant. This job requires meticulous attention to detail, the ability to navigate complex environments, like financial systems, in parentheses.
Oh my God.
A methodical strategic approach mirroring the frog's gameplay tactics. The briefcase symbolizes the responsibility and professionalism inherent in the accounting profession. And so I thought this was ridiculous.
Okay.
So I said, please describe the internal monologue of Frogger going to work as an accountant as written by Aaron Sorkin for a movie with Frogger as the main character. This should be an introductory monologue in the style of Fight Club. And I gave it a few attempts, but may I please give you my dramatic reading?
Please. Oh man.
Oh my God. Here we go.
Oh, can you do this in your American accent?
Let me see if I can clear my throat here. Every morning, it's the same reflection. I'm Frogger's stale predictability, trapped in a cycle of jump, land, repeat. I'm his 9-to-5 routine. A life measured in spreadsheets and coffee breaks. To the world, I'm Frogger's sensible shoes, treading a well-worn path from lily pad to cubicle. But inside, I'm Frogger's smoldering ambition, a wildfire, a swamp of complacency. I'm a silent scream against the humdrum, a symphony of what-ifs and if-onlys, playing on loop. I'm the dream he tucked away, a forgotten melody of the cacophony of survival. In the ledger of life, I'm Frogger's unbalanced equation, his yearning for more than just debits and credits. So watch me as I go through the motions, but know this. Inside Frogger's buttoned-up exterior beats the heart of a rebel, ready to jump into the unknown. Because I'm not just Frogger's cautious step. I'm his boundless leap. I just couldn't get over the last
one. That's pretty good.
I'm his boundless leap. Like, what is that?
Yeah. He just blew up his accounting building.
Oh my God.
That's it. That's literally it. I was just like, that is amazing that ChatGPT gave me a movie script for the Frogger accounting Fight Club movie.
Wow.
Ridiculous. So I love these questions. This is why I'm so sad we don't get to these questions at the end of the episode. But like, when we want to give these questions the authority and attention that they are due.
Wow. Wow. Next question. Raftornaut has another one. Raftornaut did half of these. He's got...
He's entitled to ask his questions.
Yes. Question for the podcast. What are the characteristics of a good instruction manual? What are some examples of things you like or dislike? Man, I really wish I would have put more research into this.
I got a list.
You got a list? Okay, let's hear them.
Number one, lore.
Okay.
I like lore in the manual. I don't like lore in the first intro of the game. If you're trying to start a game, I want to start playing the fucking game.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be like, turn on the game. It's like, here's all the backstory that we want you to know before you start playing the game. It's like, no, I'd want to be able to open a manual after I've played the game already for 45 minutes and be like, all right, that's all the people who I'm killing. Fantastic. And all these bad guys that I, you know, should be aware of. Okay, this is kind of cool. The lore is only interesting to me after I've started playing the game. Don't stick the lore down my throat before I start playing the game.
I agree with that, and I also think the lore should be shortened to the point. And I don't need 17 pages of lore. Yeah.
Well, my answer to this question again would be like, it depends. You know, like it depends on the type of game. Like if I'm playing a shoot 'em up, I don't really care about the story. All shoot 'em ups have stories, and they're all dumb. I've never seen a shoot 'em up with a compelling story. Never. Maybe, but I've nothing I can think of off the top of my
head. No, I agree with that. I think everything we're about to say is going to be couched by like certain games have exceptional things.
I mean, like, you know, like a shoot 'em up with a story, it really adds cohesion to the universe, you know, and the art direction or whatever, but it's like it doesn't make any fucking sense.
Sure.
On characters. But yeah, you know, but then you look at something like, you know, a much more fleshed out game, maybe like an RPG or something like that. You know, you're going to want more in a manual like that. So I don't know. Just, it depends. There's some games that I remember I played is a game called like maybe Stonekeep or something like that, but it was some game I got. It was a big, you know, these old big box PC games that you would get used to come. Like I got one that came with an actual book. It was like a 100-page novel, like a novella that came with the game. I don't know. I never read it. It's just like, I read like half of it and I was just like, I don't know. I didn't want to read a book right now. I wanted to play a video game.
Yeah, no, there was some, it's a really good one, dude. There was a couple of those like adventure games for PC that were like really intense. The one that I remember the most was Police Quest, which was almost like semi-notorious because the guy who made it was an ex-police officer. And so like there'd be moments in the game where you're like going to, let's say you arrested a drunk driver. So you got to bring them to the station and book them. So that you get to the, you know, the dispatch office, whatever it is, or the, you know, the admittance office. And they're like, okay, what are you booking this guy under? And you had to type in the code of like the specific. And so you had to open the manual and literally had every police code.
Yeah, but a lot of old computer games used to do this for copy protection.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I know exactly what you're saying. It was kind of like copy protection built in, but it was like, there was a number of moments in the game where you had to be like, okay, let's open the being a police officer manual and literally study to see what I'm supposed to do in this exact situation. And that was fun for like 5 fucking minutes.
Yeah.
And then the game was just like, it was just too much because you were like, yeah, to your point, I just want to play the game.
I think the final answer on this is really, it should just be, it depends on what the game is. Because a game like, let's say, Life Force, it should be press A to do this, press B to do this, start works, fly over these to get power-ups, go. In a game like Legend of Zelda, like, here's all the enemies. These are the regions you can go to. Here's the map. Here's some lore. Okay, so, here's, you know.
So the map, I think that's a special
maps case. Okay, so let's say maps. I like maps.
Yes.
Because if you're playing a game like Legend of Zelda, you kind of really want a map. And even a game as simple as Kubo 3, I found the map pretty helpful.
Oh, yeah.
So, well, I think about a game like The Machine, where it's got it's not exactly a map, but it's more like a diagram of the machine, and you can see the different levels.
Right.
I thought that was great. I kept coming back to that and just kind of, you know, examining it, especially as I got further into the game, and I could see all the detail that was put into that illustration. I would say stuff I like, you know, my first thought about this question is not every game needs a good manual.
Right.
In some cases, we just don't need it. But the ones that are good, the ones that I like, I would say they all seem to have like great artwork.
Yeah.
If it's a game that can use it, I love maps. I love to look at maps. Even if it's just a really abstract map or something like that, it's just totally to give me an idea. There was an old map that it wasn't in the manual. Konami used to have shitty manuals for its games. Sometimes just like really, really tiny. but the Castlevania 2, Dracula's Curse, and it was not a map in the game, but it was a map in Nintendo Power magazine, and it was on one of their posters. They would always have a poster of some game, and then on the back there would be like some information about maybe that game or some different game. But they had a wonderful map in Nintendo Power for Castlevania 2. And to this day, that still sticks out of my head. And I would refer back to that map when I was playing the game, and it really fleshed out the game for me.
No, I actually think on a similar level, Super Metroid, because you've said before, Nick, how you really got into Super Metroid.
I did not.
But the manual for that was like almost like a Nintendo Power issue by itself.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That had a whole glossy map centric manual around this like world that you arrive on.
It's because it was huge and you needed that.
Yeah, exactly. So like, I totally agree with you. Like if it's depending on the type of game, obviously, you know, caveat, but the map aspect can make the manual a really integral part of the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that there's, I have like another opinion myself, but I have a question for both of you, which is like, what about stuff in manuals that are kind of secrets? Like things that like give you an advantage in the game.
Oh, that's fun.
Know about if you had not read the manual. Is that fair? Is that cool?
I think it's 100% fair because it's the instruction manual. This is how you play the game. Now, on the flip side of that, like say back to The Legend of Zelda, there was a map in there, but it had a sticker sealing it. And it was like, don't break the seal only unless it's necessary. So like that, for example.
That's cool.
That's really cool because it's like it gives you a chance. You get the game gets a fair shot before you get the map. And even when you did open it, it was only like 2/3 of it. You know, there was still other stuff that was grayed out. That's what I think. If it's in the instruction manual, it's fair game. Just like now, granted, the last episode we did about Kubo 3, like Dale Coop had said in the Discord about this, the map should only be used in, you know, dire circumstances or whatever for Kubo 3. But then don't put it in the instruction manual. You know, because I've said multiple times on this podcast that like anytime I got a new NES game, first thing I did is read the instruction manual cover to cover, you know, and if it's not in the manual, then that's something to be discovered. But if it is in the manual, I think that's a tool to be used to help you along, which is
yes,
why I found the gun so fast in Kubo 3.
Right.
Well, and I mean, the map, you know, I think he just meant, you know, if you get stuck. But
sure.
It's vague enough. I think the map is vague enough. I just thought like the stars in that game were indicating where the health potions were. So I never did figure out that you could get the gun on one of those screens. But I mean, my kids really liked the map in that game. And another one is Anguna when we had that game and they looked at the map. Mm-hmm. Others, yeah, I don't know. Some other stuff I like in manuals. I don't know. Yeah, art maps, things like
that. Yeah, art's a good call because it's just like you're going to see things that are maybe more detailed. Let's be honest, we're talking about homebrew games that are on like 8-bit or 16-bit systems. The artwork is going to be more detailed than what you see on screen, so it can help kind of flesh that out.
Yeah, that's interesting point that you had there about like secrets that you put in the manual. I would say I usually when I find those, it's because I played the game and I didn't know about them, and so I get pissed when I'm realizing I could have just read the damn manual. And
Oh, last thing I'll add on that is like there's also like for me the peak aspect of like what is the most amazing thing to put in a manual and the thing that like really makes the game better or like adds to the game. And I think I can only think of one example of this, and that's Metal Gear Solid, where the game actively refers to the back of the box of the game saying, look at the back of the box to know the radio frequency to dial in to get the right thing that you need.
It's more copyright protection.
It's kind of copyright protection, but it's like so cool that it breaks the fourth wall in that way because the character directly references the game box in the game.
Yeah, that's a weird example though. They'll even like read your memory card in that game.
And yeah, but I don't know. It's like something like that where I'm like, there's just, I don't know. I think that's really interesting how they've thought through the whole experience of the game and they've even added that into the branding and the marketing of the game.
Well, it's like the letter you get from your uncle in Star Tropics that comes in the box and that's got the secret frequency code or whatever that you have to figure out. That's same thing, I think.
I just like always want to respect the thought and energy that goes into stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Talking about game art, Jeremy Parrish on Blue Sky I saw the other day had posted he was responding to somebody else who had posted. It was art from the Metroid manual, the original NES Metroid, which has comically ridiculous art. I kind of want to post a link to this, but it is, yeah, if you have not looked at the actual Metroid manual, the NES, like the silver cover, it looks almost like it was made by a child.
Oh, yeah.
Who possibly had not played the game. So it's but it had just been described.
Pencils, yeah. Yeah.
Right. It's very funny. Okay. All right. Next question. Dale Coop asks, what is your favorite homebrew? he says, favorite for the game itself, favorite homebrew physical edition to collect or have in your collection, favorite you actually own, or favorite you would like to own if the physical is too expensive or rare or not released. He goes on, this is a multi-part question. What is the homebrew you would like to have in your collection? Most precious, rare, or best game ever, but you don't have it. And finally, could you extend the question to what is for you the best homebrew? But that might cause some drama. So I think this is, I think he's referring to here. So favorite homebrew, that's one question. And then he's talking about like favorite physical. So that is one that I need to answer because you guys don't have physical games.
Mm-hmm.
And then what physical would you like to have? Okay. Well, I don't know, guys. What's your favorite homebrew? Are we going to say?
Yeah, I can say mine. It's super easy. It's Micromages. And I like it because A, it's a well-made game, and B, it is couch co-op, and it's just an excuse to get together and drink a couple of beers and play together, which is, these days, most of what I like about video games is playing with friends and the social interaction of it. It's just sitting down and playing a game by myself sometime can be a slog for me. That's why I really, really love Micromages.
I really like that answer. And for me, I was going to say I don't have a favorite. I was trying to be like real diplomatic, but I got this Analog Pocket.
Mm.
And when I finally got the cores installed and whatever, the first game I wanted to play on it was Bobble.
Mm, yeah.
Oh, really? Okay.
And so I think I shared it with you guys in like a, just a text. Like I got all 8 ducks or whatever in the game. I think Bobble has to be my favorite because it's just like, I felt like I had to almost christen my new machine by playing that game. So, yeah, weirdly, I feel like that's probably my favorite, if only just by default, because I just like go to it and I play that. So, like, I just really enjoy playing that game. The feeling of playing that game just feels really good.
Dude, I love the idea of christening a new piece of tech because right. When I got my projector in my basement right. And I'm like, what's the first movie I'm going to watch on the projector? It's going to be great. I'm like sitting in my brain going, oh, it's going to be this highbrow thing. Let's watch The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. No, both times I got a projector, it was Smokey and the Bandit.
There you go, dude. It's not that, you know? I think that's it. It's like, I mean,
so like, is that really my favorite movie?
Right.
Maybe it is.
I think it's the same thing. It's like, if somebody asked me, is Bobble the best homebrew ever? I would not say yes. But it's like,
I'd say yes to any game being the best.
Right. But it's like, I just feel, I don't know, it just feels like home in so many ways. Like it's such a nicely put together game and it's short. You know, we were talking earlier about like games that are long or short. It's a really short game.
Yeah.
And it's almost like an art piece in that it's this kind of like Zen physics engine on the NES. But yeah, I just really enjoy playing it. It just feels, literally just feels good to play.
Yeah. Hmm. I don't know. This is a tough one for me because I've played so much damn homebrew at this point. And when we started the podcast, I said, you know, I said Lizard is my favorite homebrew. So Lizard for the NES. And I always put it up there with Twin Dragons.
Oh, yeah.
Twin Dragons was the first NES homebrew game. It was the first homebrew game on any console that I ever played that really made me think, holy crap, these games are good.
Mm.
Like this is as good as like a licensed era NES game. You know, this would have been top tier. And it really opened my eyes to the whole community. And I'm like, I really got to dive in and check these games out. So I would say Twin Dragons is definitely up there at the top of the list. Lizard, of course, I still have very affectionate feelings towards. But I don't know, man. We've played so many games for this podcast that I would put way high on that list. Witch and Wiz, I have great warm, fuzzy feelings towards Witch and Wiz.
Mm.
The Machine?
Yeah.
The Machine is a fucking work of art, man.
It really is.
I'll tell you what. And that's one that I am going to start recommending to people. Like, if you just love a narrative heavy game, like, that is just mind blowing that he packed that much narrative into a freaking Game Boy game. Mm-hmm. You know, best writing I've ever seen in a homebrew. Some of the best writing I've ever seen in a video game.
Mm-hmm. I'll jump on that bandwagon. I think Deadeus was just so much fun for me. That made me realize the Game Boy was like on the map too.
That's also a game that I'm glad we didn't really get a map for.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, some games you don't want to have a map because that's part of the fun. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then is to take it to the physical side. What's my favorite physical homebrew? Well, so I have quite a few here behind me on the shelf. Most of my homebrew that I have is NES. I have a few Game Boy games, so I'm very biased towards NES on this question. But I don't know. That's a tough call. I'm going to say I don't have any one favorite. I will talk about some of my favorites. So Limited Run Games did a release of the 8-bit Music Power games. So 8-bit Music Power, 8-bit Music Power Final, and then Kira Kira Star Knight. They released three of those in a, you can get them as like one set, but it's three separate NES games. And the packaging on those was just beautiful, just really nice. And a cool little, they were clearly inspired by the Famicom releases, which had their own cool Famicom packaging. But I mean, like, that's Famicom games just kind of look like that. Whereas, you know, with the NES, to take those Famicom aesthetics and see it like in NES cartridges is just a really neat thing. And, you know, if you think about collecting games is really about having shelf candy, like, they actually do look like candy, you know, they're like candy.
Right.
So they have that. It's like literal, like, shelf candy is what it looks like. But yeah, so I really like having those. They've done some others, the Always Awakening, which I have not played yet, but it is a beautiful package. Witch and Wiz is very nice as well. I'm just sitting here looking at these. I don't know. I Full Quiet. I got the Full Quiet Limited with the shiny silver cartridge.
Mm.
You know, some of these I really like. I've got the Astro Ninja Man on Famicom. I've got Over Object on Famicom. I don't know. That's a really tough question for me because there's a lot of really good ones out there. But yeah, I would say, you know, when I think about really nice packaging on a physical game, I would say those 8-bit Music Power carts through Limited Run really kind of stand out to me. But let me see. Favorite you would like to own? Well, probably something expensive. I don't know. Starkeeper would be nice.
Something's going to appreciate in value.
Something's going to appreciate about it. Yeah, Starkeeper was a game that has it has a funny backstory. So for that guy came onto like Nintendo Age and said, "I'm going to release this game." Some guy in China, but he's going to like release 50 carts on, you know, up for auction or something like that. I can't remember how he did it, but there were all kinds of problems with it. And yeah, it had some really weird custom mapper, and so you couldn't dump the ROM. So the only way to play this game, which a lot of people said was really good, was to get one of the cartridges, which immediately went up to like $1,000 each.
Right.
So
I remember you talking about this before.
Yeah. And so, you know, this people would post photos on Nintendo Age or Video Game Sage, and they'll have like their copy of Starkeeper, and it has like a beer sitting on it or something. but you know, it's like it's $1,000 Nintendo game. But then the guy just recently put Starkeeper on Steam. And you can buy it now for like $3 and you can play the game. And I got to say, like, it's okay. Yeah. It's all right. It's not bad.
All this buildup of like.
The mystique is better.
It's definitely worth $3. You know, it's okay. It's all right.
That's a fun.
It is not. It's not that deep. You know, it's a little bit like. Reminds me of a little like a black box game, like where, you know, like a balloon fight or something like that. That kind of mechanic, if I'm remembering correctly. I didn't play it for that long, but it was okay. Yeah, it was all right. It's not a $800 game, $1,000 game, but yeah. Well, if I had a physical of that, that would be nice because I could sell it for $800. Wait, then, yeah, I don't know. There's other stuff like that. There's a lot of those collector editions that guys made for their games that come out, you know, that, now, like Kevin Hanley was talking about his version of Frogger when he did a Frogger port, he put out it was like in a little box. It was called Pink Lady Frogger, and for a while it was on eBay for like $1,000. That would be fun stuff to have. But what would I like to have that I don't have? I tell you what I would like to have that I don't have right now is the Dungeons and Doom Knights Collector's Edition.
That has
the shiny gold cartridge, and it has like gold foil print on the package, and that just looks really super nice. But I have not pulled the trigger and bought it. It is $100.
I think that's the one for me too, and I'll never pull the trigger on it.
Yeah, I like that game a whole lot, but
me too.
You know, $100 buys a lot of digital ROMs. So
yes.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe.
Oh, and the only thing I'll add to that, like, what do I want to have? Because now I actually have an analog pocket, so I can actually play Game Boy cartridges.
Yeah, that's right. You can play it. Yeah. Okay.
So the only one that I've seen that I kind of like is, I mean, for me, it would be the actual cartridge, and if the cartridge looked cool. And there is this one called Windows 93 Adventure, which is so stupid, but it has this, like, cool, I don't know, just, like, weird Memphis aesthetic. Like it's like pink cartridge, the Game Boy cartridge. I just think that's really cool. I kind of would go for it. It's like limited edition, sold out, so you can't get it anymore. You have to get it on eBay. I don't know what the price is, but if anybody wants to donate it to the podcast, you know, just throw it out there.
Yeah, same with two cartridges of Dungeons and Doom Knights. That'd be great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the old ones, please. Yep. No, but you know, I should say before we move on, I do have two Game Boy games. Physical. One of them is The Machine from Incubate Games. I highly recommend that. Very nice quality packaging. The other one is Shapeshifter 2, which I got through a Kickstarter. That one, I really wanted the physical of it because it is a game that is spread out across two cartridges. So it goes back and forth, and it's got like a little spinny wheel that tells you where to go. I have not gotten into the game yet. I've been waiting for like some time because it looks like a game you're going to really have to dive into. But that is a very nice little package, and I strongly recommend that one if you can find it. That was a game that, you know, if it's going to put it across like two ROMs, two cartridges, I just thought, okay, I got to play this like physically. I got to see how this works to pop the cartridge in and out, and how does that add or detract from the game experience? In fact, that's on our list. Like one day I would love to cover that game for the podcast, but
it's on the list.
Yeah, so... just a shout out to that one. All right, we got two questions left, guys. Two questions left. All right. Raftronaut asks, what is the podcast's favorite movie about video games? And his guess, somebody's going to say War Games. But
I've never seen War Games. I've seen all the tropes about it. I've never sat down and watched that. And before we sat down for this, I was like reading that question. And I was trying to think of what is... that, like, what is a video game movie? Because it's like a lot of things. Like, is it a game that's like Mario Movie, which is like an IP from video games that's like put into a movie form, or is it like a game about like some hypothetical movie, the hypothetical video game that gets turned into some plot device?
Oh, like Brain Scan.
Yeah. Like, I mean, yeah. I asked, similar to what we were saying earlier, I asked ChatGPT, and like, remember that movie Existence?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
That's a Cronenberg film.
That's what I was going to say. That was my pick. That was the movie I was going to talk about.
Oh, okay. You go. Go for it, dude. Get in. Get in with Existence.
Have you seen that?
Yeah, actually.
That movie's awesome. Yeah.
It's a great movie. Yeah, so it's a David Cronenberg movie from like 1999, I think, or something.
I wasn't ready for it. I'll put it that way. I mean, I don't think it was a bad movie, but I was not ready for that movie when it came out.
I think that is, yeah. I mean, first of all, if you're familiar with David Cronenberg, it's...
I was not when I first watched that fucking movie.
Okay.
I need to rewatch it. It's been a long time.
No, it is. It's got a very kind of 90s indie gritty film kind of feel to it, but it is...
That's the movie with the chicken gun, right?
Yes, that's right. Basically my overriding memory of the whole fucking movie.
Me too.
Yeah, David Cronenberg does a lot of body horror, and even though this is a movie that is ostensibly about video games, there is a lot of disgusting body horror in it that will stick out in your mind. It is a game. It is a movie where, so the participants are, it is a group of participants, and they're playing a virtual reality game.
Right.
And I don't want to set it up any more than that. I just want to say it is a virtual reality game, and it kind of runs with that concept. And it, you know, it has philosophical questions about, you know, immersive media and things like that.
I think it's like, when I think of that movie now, I think that would be a Black Mirror episode.
Okay, right. Yeah.
Like, that's kind of the vibe that I get from it now when I think back. Because I haven't watched it since I watched it in early 2000s.
Yeah, I think now you've got a lot more media that has a similar kind of vibe to this. But back in the 90s, when I watched this movie for the first time, my mind was blown. You know, I thought it was very impressive.
Yes.
And it definitely has a kind of, you know, and again, I don't want to give it away, but it has this kind of Inception sort of thing going on where you're, by the end of the movie, you're really questioning what the hell is going on.
Yes, totally. But that's the thing. Like, if I think of like a video game movie, that isn't necessarily the first thing that comes to my mind.
That's true. Yeah. I don't know if that's if it's really a video game movie. Like, I don't know after watching that movie if David Cronenberg has actually ever played a video game.
Oh, sure.
I really don't.
Right.
It's like he read on like in like a book what a video game was, and he's like, I'm going to make a movie about these things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's totally it. No, I completely agree.
No, I was just going to say mine's very similar to that. I already said it, but there's the first thing that popped into my head was The Wizard, the Fred Savage movie that, you know.
Oh, sure. Right. You
know, because it was just a 2-hour long ad for Super Mario Brothers 3, basically. But
yeah, but when I was like 10, that was the best thing I'd ever seen in my life.
Oh, yeah. You know? It was great. But honestly, the one for me is Brain Scan. If you haven't seen Brain Scan, I don't want to set it up. I don't want to say anything about it. I think you just need to find the movie Brain Scan starring Edward Furlong, who played John Connor in Terminator 2, and watch it without knowing anything about it. I haven't seen it in 20 years, but I just, the memory I have of that movie, which still sticks with me to this day, is it's one of those movies that I was blown away by the ending. And who knows, somebody that watches it today, a little more savvy film goer, because we've had a lot of movies that are kind of like this, you might see the ending coming a mile away. But
right.
Yeah, it was, it blew me away when I first saw it.
I think for me, because I was thinking about this, and I was like, is my favorite video game movie a movie that's like a video game property? Like, I was thinking of like, I don't know, things like Judge Dredd, like, you know, comics that were made in movies in the 90s that were like not so good.
Yeah.
And like, okay. And then even like more recently, there's things like, it was like Free Guy. That's like,
Yeah.
Like, I haven't seen that, but it's like oriented entirely around the idea that like everybody is like fluent in video game culture and knows what video games are, right?
You should check that out. It's not bad.
Cool. I will actually, because that does look pretty fucking funny. But the movie that I think is my favorite video game movie is King of Kong.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That's a really good pick. That is a really good pick. Yeah.
And it's because I just, when I think of that movie, oh my God, dude, it is such a great movie. It is just.
It is. Yeah, no, my wife loves that movie.
Oh, she's my God, dude. You cannot write a story that is as engaging. Like, ChatGPT couldn't make a fucking story like King of Kong.
No.
So what? Describe for anybody who hasn't seen it. What's that movie
okay,
about?
So let's actually, this is going to be from my memory, but so please interrupt and correct me if I'm wrong. The game, the arcade game Donkey Kong, is notoriously difficult to get the best high score on. It's a very unforgiving game. It's a very punishing game. So the people who go for the high score in this game are pretty intense individuals. And the record holder at the time of the movie being recorded was this guy called Billy Mitchell.
Billy Mitchell.
And he is a character, and he is, the moment you see this guy on the screen, he is 100% unlikable. You just hate this guy. Like, he just reminds you of the high school bully. No matter what you do, no matter who you are, you look at this guy, you're like, this guy's a douche. And there's this other guy. And the irony is, I don't even remember the main character, the guy who's the actual hero of the movie.
Yeah, Steve Wiebe.
Yes. He is like a retired teacher. And he's like got, like, he used to be able to play piano. And he's always kind of gone. This is like a little part of the movie where his wife is talking about, oh, he's always had like a talent for stuff, but he's never really kind of seen it through. And Donkey Kong is going to be the thing that he sees through. And oh my God, this guy, Steve Wiebe, goes to basically beat the high score, the world high score for Donkey Kong Arcade. And it becomes this epic. It becomes this like Game of Thrones fucking thing.
it's amazing.
Yeah. I can say with honesty, because I met Steve Wiebe.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah, because at the time that this movie got big, I was working in gaming, and he was hired to play Donkey Kong at GDC.
Oh, wow, okay.
At the Games Developers Conference in San Francisco. And he would just sit there and he just, like, playing Donkey Kong. And people were like, oh, my God, it's this dude. And so he was there just literally getting paid to play Donkey Kong in front of people. It was wild. Like, just so weird. But that movie, oh, my God. It's like, I still remember the trailer for it, even. It's like in the Hall of the Mountain King. And like it just builds and it builds and it builds. And that's the whole movie. It just builds. It's just so crazy. I love that movie. It is the best game movie. It's the best movie about video games that I think you could make.
That's a pretty good. I like that. I like that. Yeah. I'd recommend that to people way before I'd recommend Existence.
If you don't. Unless you already know what the fucking chicken gun is, just watch King of Kong, dude.
I also think Atari Game Over was pretty good one.
Oh yeah,
did you guys see this one? No, it's the one about Atari and all the ET cartridges tossed into the landfill.
Oh, right. Okay. They made a movie about that.
Yeah, and they go to the landfill and they dig down and find them.
Oh wow,
yeah, it's really good.
Oh, I didn't even know that one.
Yep,
I think that's the story here. I think that's the story. Video games don't make great movies unless they're documentaries. Documentaries about video games can be really good.
Yeah.
Gold.
I think, video games don't make great movies, but movies about video games. Wizard. Wizard was good.
Wizard. Wizard. I love The Wizard.
It's so bad.
So bad. Yeah.
But yeah, Connor and everybody listening to this, watch Atari Game Over. It's it's fun to see an urban legend that is 100% true, and you watch them prove that it's 100% true. It's great. Yeah,
The Wizard was excellent at its job, which was to market game stuff to children. I know I was obsessed with getting a Power Glove after I watched that movie.
Me too.
And I bugged my parents to get me one, and you know what? The movie was correct. It was so bad.
Yeah. It was really bad. Not in the 80s sense of the term bad.
No, it was
not.
It was
in the Michael Jackson sense. No.
It did look cool as hell though, man. When I was a kid, that stupid douche that played Rad Racer with the Power Glove, he was the coolest kid in the world to me. I wanted to be him so bad, and I wanted the Power Glove so bad.
I found my old Power Glove. I have it, and I gotta tell you, like, even after all these years, it still does look extremely cool.
Yeah, I wish they had made a left-handed version also. Then you could have, like, had two of them. There's like a superhero with two power gloves. Yeah. I'm surprised they haven't done something like that for the new VR systems that are out.
Where's the homebrew games for power gloves?
That's what
somebody needs to make one.
Oh,
there's homebrew games for the power pad that you put on the ground, but. All right.
What's the Venn diagram? What's the Venn diagram of people that own a power glove and like homebrew games?
Well, it might be like three people. Yeah. But still,
they're probably really good at making homebrew games.
Yeah. I want to see that guy get his game finally. That one guy out there. All right. Last question. Wido asks, what do you think about physical game releases? Sometimes homebrew games are physical only because the developers think that selling ROMs devalue their games. However, sometimes I think the physical copies are way too expensive for what it is, especially if you add shipping and import fees. So he's asking there, like, what do you think about people who do not release their games digitally?
Gosh, I heard this story one time about a guy that released about 50 copies of a game and it went up to $1,000 and then all of a sudden released the ROM on Steam and somebody on this podcast played it and was like, it's okay. I think we almost have covered that already.
No, I tell you, this kicked off a very long conversation on Discord among, we have a lot of homebrew developers who are on Discord. I have very strong opinions about this. I think that people should do with their games what they want to do with their games.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I think the decision to not release it digitally as a fan who plays games, I don't like that. And, even the stuff like, I'll kind of make an exception for the Retrotainment guys because they make really good stuff like Full Quiet. Full Quiet has never had a ROM released. They've never released ROMs of their other games like Haunted Halloween games, and at least they put them on Steam, So I realize what they're kind of doing there. I think they do it as a way to like prevent piracy or whatever. But, you know, as some other folks on this podcast can attest, like, it's not that hard to find a ROM of Full Quiet. Like, you can do it pretty easy.
This is true.
And some of these other games, you know, a lot of games out of Japan do not, homebrew games do not release the games digitally. Well, that sucks if you don't live in Japan, because those games are hard to get. You know, it's, first of all, you got to navigate the different online shops for Japanese games, which are almost always in Japanese. And then you have to ship internationally. You know, a lot of these guys don't want to ship. Maybe you got to use like a proxy service and all this. It's a pain in the ass. And you know, like I say, like, I really want to recommend games like OverObject to people, OverObj. But it's really damned hard to get that game because you can only get it on physical cart from Japan. Mm-hmm. And I had to use like it was a proxy service through like Beep website or something. It's not something I can just tell people to do. And it was an expensive game. It ended up being like $80, which is a lot for a homebrew game. It's a lot, especially if you don't know you're going to like it.
Right.
I wish that homebrewers who do that would strongly reconsider, you know, or at least maybe after a period of time.
Yeah.
There was some interesting back and forth about this on the Discord, and I just want to highlight it for posterity here on the podcast. So let me pull that up real quick.
Sure. I think, your main point, though, which is that obviously the developer of the game, like, fully respect whatever decision they make. I just feel like there is this tension between the amount of effort that goes into the game and the piracy protection that clearly is worth putting in. Versus reaching an audience, you know, like reaching the people who want to play the game.
Well, but it can almost be done like the movie model. You know, you've got your quote unquote physical release. That's the theatrical release. And the people that really want to play it early and like collect it, then go get it, you know. But even if it's a year later to come out with a digital release or even a non-special edition physical release, you know, like you have the Dungeons and Doom Nights gold-only copy that you can buy when it first releases, and then 6 months later, we've got the regular copy coming out, and then 6 months later, here, now you can get the ROM. You know, it's kind of like, I feel like how they're doing it in the movie business, it's almost like they're trying to just milk all the money out of it that they can, but I think it seems to work.
I don't think that's a bad idea. I just know that that is already putting more work on the people who make the game, because then they have to like have this whole release strategy. And I know myself from just like interacting with the people who make these kind of games, they usually don't enjoy marketing. They don't enjoy having a strategy.
It sucks. Having to do all that stuff yourself sucks.
Yeah. Like, the game's done. I want to get it out and move on to the next game.
Kind of, right?
I get that.
That's how I feel about every podcast episode we record. I have to go promote it on social media, and I fucking hate it every time.
He's already dreading the editing of this, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, edit, and then it's posting the social media is a giant pain in the ass.
Especially now, because it's like...
Yeah, like, I used to just put it on Twitter, you know, and now I post it to like six places, so... No, okay, so Treed had a good point about this. He says, my thing with digital releases is they shouldn't come before the physical ones have shipped. So that's kind of like... If you got if you back a Kickstarter that's got a physical release and a digital release, you know, he's saying it's not very fair to put out the digital before you get the physical. I would say yes, with the caveat, most of these, if you buy the physical, you also get the digital copy. If you're just going to put the digital out there for everybody, including the people who got the physical, I think that's a good compromise. In fact, somebody did that for Witch and Wiz, I think. For limited run games, when you bought the physical through limited run, you actually got a download code for the physical game that you could play immediately. So I didn't get that game for like a year, but I got the code for it, which I already had it through Itch. But I thought that was really cool, and I wish they would do that more often.
That also lets you play the game to your heart's content without actually opening your CIB, you know, thus keeping it more in the collector's space, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, a lot of these folks, they're collectors. They're not going to open the thing anyway.
So. Right. And so there's the tension is there around, like, are you making a game for somebody who's never going to open the box?
Right. Well, it's like these, you know, action figure collectors and stuff. Like, I was at Walmart the other day, and they've got the old school 80s G.I. Joe action figures there, and the like Cobra Commander looked exactly the way it did in the 80s, and it's $20. And I'm like, who the hell is going to pay $20 for a 3.5-inch figure? kids, no right. way, you know, and it's going to be somebody that had it when they were a kid and is buying it now. And like, even it, I did the calculation on that. It was like $350 for a figure back in the '80s, which even with inflation to right. now
you're is kind of like pushing it
$8-$9 maybe. But $20, that's well over double the price. That's, would your mom have bought you a G.I. Joe figure if it was $7 in 1985? Fuck no.
No.
Yeah.
You guys mentioned word of mouth. You know, I think that's the last kind of point I want to make with this stuff is, you know, if you put the game out there digitally, more people are going to play it.
True.
And the more people who play it, the more people are going to tell other people to play it. And I can just say, like, word of mouth, if you want to get on this podcast as one of the games that we pick for our big numbered episodes that we do a deep dive on, you know, you kind of have to release the game digitally, because I have a real hard time recommending. I mean, the whole kind of shtick that we've got with this podcast is play along with us. You know, mm-hmm. it's hard for me to recommend people to play along with us if they don't have access to a digital copy of the game. One example of this is Circus Convoy, which is a game for the Atari 2600 that was made by David Crane, the creator of Pitfall. And he released this game just a few years ago. I want to say like maybe 2018, something like that. Maybe not. No, 2021. Yeah. Circus Convoy for the Atari, but you know, never released digitally. You can get a digital copy of the game if you buy like the special edition. So if you pay like $100,
okay,
you can get a digital copy and it's numbered.
I suppose that's technically in the, you know, according to what we're saying, which is making a digital copy available, but it's a big commitment for us to say to people yeah. who are listening, pay $100 for this.
Right. And I mean, you know, it's like, I really want to cover this game for the podcast, but it's like, okay, I can't.
David, get your shit together. David, come
yeah,
on.
Right. Wow.
No. But it's, yeah, it's, I, you know, if people could play it, if people had access to the ROM, if they could go pay $10 and get it on itch, then I would play the game for the podcast. But,
right,
you know, they, you get a digital copy and it's numbered, I guess, so they know like who's put it out there. Right. I guess I don't know what they do about it, but, and I'm sure you can probably find a copy of the ROM somewhere, but I can't really do that. You know, I don't want to endorse people to go do that. So
yeah, I don't care for that either.
I have a really hard time. It's one thing to get ROMs of like old games that sure. aren't released anymore. It's another to get ROMs of games that people are out there making and trying to sell right now. But yeah, I mean, I think that's a great example of a game that I have wanted to cover this for like a year. And I won't, you know, I probably won't, just because it's, people can't play along to it, you know?
No, so. It's fair. It's totally, and that's a legitimate choice to make. It's totally up to these creators, what they want to do with their creations. And it's not our place to tell them how to share them with everybody else. But if you are looking to reach a larger audience, it does hold you back if you're only going to do a physical release.
I think so. And I think attitudes on this have really changed. I remember listening to some old Assembly Line episodes, and Bo and Kevin were talking about, you know, they were defending it. You know, they were like, we don't release our games digitally. And this was way back in the day. But, you know, then they're like, pay to play. That's how it works. But they, I think they've come around on it. I know Kevin has released a lot of his games for free on his website. Mm. It's one thing when you're just making games for a really small group of people, like your friends on Nintendo Age. And it's another thing when you're trying to reach a larger audience and people who may not have the physical media like you guys, you know.
Well, also, I don't know if that audience existed back in the day, right? Like now we're discovering that there's a huge audience that really might actually enjoy these games. And I don't know if those people were, like that audience existed when people were making the games back in the physical only era.
Right. Okay. Do we have anything else to talk about today, guys? Are we kind of done? No. That was fun.
Yeah.
I like these kind of episodes, you know, where we can just kind of bullshit. It's fun.
Yes.
And, you know, we didn't talk about it. We've been doing this for 2 years now, guys.
Whoa.
2 years. Yes, it's true. That's 2 years at the end of October.
Holy cow.
So, I know, right?
Like I missed that anniversary.
I know. I did too. I didn't even think about it.
Well, I wouldn't say I missed it, guys.
I mean, we're still here.
Still here. Homebrew Game Club.
Still brewing.
Catch us on Anniversary 3.
Yeah. Right?
All right. This has been the Homebrew Game Club podcast. You can find links to our Discord, previous episodes of the show, or other social media links, maybe some new swag. We might have some new swag up by the time. Wow. At homebrewgameclub.com. And you can look for us on your social media app of choice at HB Game Club. If you like the show, please help us out by leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That does help immensely. Please do that if you haven't yet. Or by telling all of your retro gaming friends about our podcast. If you have comments or a suggestion for a game that you would like to hear us talk about, shoot us a message on social media or email us at homebrewgameclub@gmail.com. Our opening music is by Twee. You can find him on X at TUI2A03, where you can also find a link to his SoundCloud. Our outro music is by Raftronaut. You can find him on X at 0000Jordan. You can find me, Nick, on your favorite social media apps of choice as Dvertov. That's Dvertov. Bart is on Instagram as Clever Username Needed, no spaces. And Connor is on various social media at Connornash, also no spaces. Tune in next time to the Homebrew Game Club when we will be talking about some game. I'm not sure yet what, as we are recording, but we will be talking about some game for some console, and it's going to be great.
It's going to be sexy.
It's going to be so good. Thank you for listening. Yeah.
I just feel I have to put in a sexy comment there. You know, I got to get the audience sexy. Worked up.
Yeah.
Got to get all them right. Pumped.